and gentlemen, your attention, please.
Hello.
Hey, look who's here.
Hi. I was wondering what they're going to be doing with that Pete McMurray's. Not a big fan of his.
Ignition sequence start. 3, 2, 1. Liftoff. We have a liftoff.
Here's Pete McMurray on 720 WGN.
It's great to be here Thursday night, Friday, almost Friday morning in the Allstate Skyline Studios. Our phone number, 312-981-7200. Also, I'm getting some great text messages. Thank you, Jeff and Hammond. The end is near. No Canadian hockey teams made it out of the first round, and yet they have the NBA title. So true, my friend. Yes, thank you, Bobby D. I know, a Canadian team won the NBA championship. What is going on? BB riding shotgun tonight, producing the show. How are you doing?
I'm doing fabulous. How are you doing?
We got a packed show tonight.
Yes, we do.
Very, very packed show. Again, our phone number, 312-981-7200. Let's get to our first guest, shall we?
Again, all this is presumption now. It's apparent that the police believe it.
Well,
and that
not
is
great.
Cowling's car, and that Simpson is in the driver's seat. We've received a report of a gun in the car. The car is heading north, which would be toward Los Angeles. We picked it up in Orange County. The vehicle is registered to Al Cowling, a former teammate, close friend of O.J. Simpson's, who has been a fugitive from justice now almost 12 hours.
25 years ago, two murders kicked off a series of events that would lead to the trial of the century. It was late in the night of June 12, 1994, that Nicole Brown Simpson and Ron Goldman were stabbed to death in her Los Angeles home. They were found 25 years ago this morning. Within hours, the LAPD said O.J. Simpson was a possible witness. Then he became a suspect. He had to fly back from Chicago to L.A. 25 years after the trial of the century, Kim Goldman, sister of murder victim Ron Goldman, is digging deep into the vicious crime that changed her life forever. She has a new podcast called Confronting O.J. Simpson, 25 years after the trial of the century, and Kim Goldman joins us now. Kim, I'm so sorry for your loss. It was such a tragic ending to Ron's life. And here we are 25 years later, and we all remember it like it was yesterday.
Yeah, I appreciate that, Pete. It's been hard. It's been weird to think that it's 25 years because it feels so raw and so fresh for me. My brother would have been 50 now, and that's pretty crazy to think about all the things that we missed out on experiencing life with him with.
You know, you've been on with me a few times over the years, and I've said this to you before. Good for you for keeping Ron and Nicole's name alive and for keeping us aware now 25 years later. It's just crazy that it's been 25 years.
Yeah, it's you know, this case hasn't, it shifts, you know, over the years. And there's a whole new generation of people that are learning about it and reading about it. And because there's so much media and there's so much access that it was hard for me to let people think that what they were seeing on these fictionalized shows, you know, was the truth. And so part of wanting to do the podcast and talking about Ron and Nicole and what happened was because I want people to understand what really happened from the people that were there every single day,
right,
as opposed to these fictionalized characters.
How is your father?
My dad is, my dad's doing okay. He's semi-retired in Arizona. He also volunteers as a victim advocate for, a police department there. And so he gets great comfort in being able to help others.
What was your first reaction when OJ was released from prison back in October of 2017?
I felt a sense of dread. I had a reprieve from anxiety. You know, when he was out walking free for such a long time, I never knew where he was going to pop up. And I was just had this angst that I was inside my heart that I didn't realize I was living with until he was in prison for 9 years.
Right.
So that kind of came back very quickly. As soon as he was released on parole, that whole process was kind of embarrassing.
Oh, it was just terrible. I mean, here's a murderer that is just walking free and playing golf every day in Las Vegas. And still in the public eye, he is not laying low. And the arrogance that he has to just go out in public and think that everything is fine is just crazy.
Yeah, we've been told by a number of people that he's living a pretty large life in Las Vegas, and he's treated very kindly there. I haven't read the whole article, but I heard snippets of a piece that he said recently, that he's living in a no no negative zone or something. It's all positive, and that they don't talk about this at all, which I think does such a disservice to Nicole and her kids.
Right.
His kids to not talk about it. I don't get that.
We're talking about Kim Goldman. The podcast is called Confronting O.J. Simpson, 25 years after the trial of the century. We've seen so many miniseries done about the trial of the century. The FX series, ESPN did a series. So many mistakes were made during the investigation and the trial. And then it came down to a black versus cops issue. What do you confront in the podcast? What is different that we don't know now?
You know, the conversations are a lot more candid. The conversations that I'm having with Tom Lang, for example, the lead detective, he talks to me about why certain pieces of evidence, or wondering why certain pieces of evidence weren't put on in the criminal case. His feeling is you put every single thing in and see what sticks. Marcia Clark talks about why she didn't put some of those pieces on and the strategy behind that. I honestly had forgotten about some of the things that Tom Lang mentioned, so it was hard for me to hear all of the evidence that wasn't included.
Right.
Having said that, the jurors that I spoke to, I don't think it would have made a difference. They pretty much believed that the police department bungled the entire case and that there was a conspiracy to frame the killer, frame a guilty man. I don't really know what they think, but in that regard, but they believe that the cops were all bungling idiots, but they were smart enough to plant evidence and frame somebody. I think that you'll be interested to hear the jurors talk about deliberations and how that was kind of BS. Talk to some of the witnesses, one witness that didn't make the witness stand and then two that did, and what their experience was like.
Who is the witness that didn't make the witness stand?
Jill Shively. She was the young woman that saw the killer driving erratically in a white Bronco leaving the scene. She didn't know what she was witnessing, but she saw him with his headlights off, driving right in the area where the crimes were committed. And she sold her story to tabloid television at the time, and Marcia decided that that made her an incredible witness, and that she's carried a tremendous amount of guilt with her.
After the ESPN series, I was so upset with Marcia Clark and Chris Darden. It's not personal to me. I can't imagine how upset you were. How do you get over that, or how did you confront Marcia and get past that and have her on the podcast?
You know, because I don't start out having those feelings, I think, you know, I've had 25 years to think about it. I think that what was going on during that trial, I think Marcia and Chris and the whole prosecution team did the best that they could under the circumstances. I think it's really easy for us now, 10, 15, 20, 25 years later, to have feelings about what they did or didn't do and mistakes that were made. I don't know that I see them all as mistakes. I think I can go that route if I want to, but at that time they did the best that they could, and they were the only ones fighting for my brother and Nicole. So I can't let myself go to that place with them. They sacrificed a lot, they compromised a lot, they suffered a lot, and my anger needs to be focused on the person that killed my brother, and that's O.J. Simpson.
Have you seen O.J. since the civil trial?
Have I seen him since the civil trial? Just in the courtroom for the Vegas, my dad and I were able to get in for the sentencing phase of that trial, but that's it.
Got it. How do you remember your brother, Ron Goldman, this week?
I remember my brother every day. It's exacerbated this week because I'm very aware of the timeline and what he was doing in his final moments and all the days that follow. My brother is the closest thing to my heart besides my son and my dad. And I talk to him in the car. I talk to him in my head. I talk to him out loud just in case he can hear me. I visit him a lot in the cemetery. And I try to live my life with the same purpose and integrity that he did, and hope that that's a legacy that stays on.
The name of the new podcast is called Confronting O.J. Simpson, 25 years after the trial of the century. Kim Goldman, God bless you and your family, Kim. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you so much, Pete.
All right, Mr. Simpson, would you please stand and face the jury?
Superior Court of California, County of Los Angeles, in the matter of the people of the state of California versus Orenthal James Simpson, case number BA-097-211. We, the jury, in the above entitled action, find the defendant Orenthal James Simpson not guilty of the crime of murder in violation of Penal Code Section 187A, a felony upon Nicole Brown Simpson, a human being, as charged in count one of the information.
It's 720 WGN.
This is Larry King as we stay atop this scene. The car is not exceeding the speed limit, and the police are not forcing it and are not pulling it over. You see them all trailing it. That's the California Highway Patrol are trailing it, but not pulling it over.
Show the people on the bridges, Jeff.
Pat, we're just now crossing the 605.
California Highway Patrol is also telling
so
CNN,
we're starting
and
to get
I'm
up
repeating
into
this
the,
to you as I hear it in my earphones.
North East Long Beach.
But again, O.J. appears to be holding a gun to his head.
720 WGN. 25 years ago today, the bodies of Nicole Brown Simpson and Ron Goldman were found in the courtyard of Nicole's Brentwood condo. Did the police botch the investigation? Did the prosecution make huge mistakes? Joining us from Clifford Law Offices is attorney Bob Clifford. Thank you for coming on so late. We appreciate it. How are you, Bob?
Hey, Pete. Good to be with you. And yes to all the above. They botched the investigation. The coppers didn't handle everything correctly. They lied during their testimony, and they gave this guilty man every opportunity to walk, or so some would say.
Well, think back 25 years ago when you first heard about the murders. And remember, if people don't remember, O.J. flew to Chicago. He was staying in a hotel next to O'Hare.
Yes, he was. And what did the local police do there?
They had metal detectors.
Yes.
He flew back to L.A., and they brought out the metal detectors, and they were looking for the knife. They were looking for the murder weapon.
Exactly. And, that case riveted the nation and the world for months. You know, you just played in the opening the low-speed chase in the white Bronco.
Right.
That was watched by tens of millions of people. This matter, this case, captured the attention of the world like no other case has before or since.
Well, it was 25 years ago this morning that they found the body. So the murder was committed the night before, and the chase was 4 days later. So it happened on June 17th, 1994.
Well, the police tell you that he was always a person of interest.
Right, right.
And he had a tumultuous relationship with his wife. There was a history of a lot of trouble. He was known to be an insanely jealous man. So his reputation preceded him.
Right.
And then put him on the very close watch list of the police. And he finally burst and couldn't take it anymore. He was holed up at his friend is Al Colley's home and jumped into, you know, the Bronco and took off. But, you know, it wasn't like he was going 90 miles an hour. We all saw it to this day. We could close our eyes and you could see that Bronco going along the California highway and expressway.
Bob, it's one of those moments where you remember exactly where you were.
Correct. Well, I don't know if I remember where it was, but I remember watching it.
I was in a bar in Rockford, believe it or not, an Irish pub called Stash O'Neill's, in the NBA Finals or the Knicks.
Yes.
Were playing on TV, right?
Yes, it interrupted the finals. This case, for so many reasons, was just unprecedented. It captivated the nation. It captivated the world.
We're talking with Bob Clifford, attorney Bob Clifford. Now, what were your thoughts 25 years ago when the evidence started rolling out? You know, the blood in the Bronco and the shoes, the shoe prints were matching. I mean, as you think about this, and I've seen the miniseries, I saw the ESPN series, you've probably seen this over the years. What were your thoughts as the evidence started to roll out?
Well, you know, as at that time, of course, I'm a lawyer of, maybe a little over a decade, 10 and a half, 15 years, and I'm watching it and I'm saying, look, it looks like a pretty strong case to me. But then, of course, they assembled what became known in legal circles as the Dream Team. You had the likes of F. Lee Bailey, Johnny Cochran, Robert Shapiro, Robert Kardashian, who came out of retirement as a lawyer to reactivate his license to get involved in the case. You had Barry Scheck, who this day is probably the foremost leader in forensic evidence and its use at trial. He assembled this team of lawyers that was extremely formidable versus the likes of Marcia Clark and
Christopher
Darden.
Right.
Even the then District Attorney Gil Garcetti, whose son now is the mayor of L.A., but Garcetti said that Marcia Clark really wasn't his first choice. She ignored the advice of jury consultants. You know, in our world, Pete, we use jury research virtually in every case that we're handling.
Absolutely.
It's very predictive. It's very valuable. And apparently Marcia Clark had the benefit of that, but deliberately chose to go with her instincts as distinguished from the research, and it really came back to bite her. And she was, you know, up against trial lawyers. You know, Johnny Cochran, I had the privilege of knowing Johnny Cochran. He was a friend. Johnny and I did a mock trial one time for the American Bar Association in Canada, and it was a recreation of the sinking of the Titanic and how would it be presented to a jury nowadays. And Johnny came up with the line, you know, you recall the very famous line, if it doesn't fit, you got to, you know, acquit.
Right, right.
Johnny came up with a line for that mock trial for the sinking of the Titanic that said, if you build a boat, it's got to float. she was up against really formidable talent.
Yeah.
And so was Darden, and they were out-lawyered, they were out-gunned, the lawyers were able to show that the police did not dot their I's, cross their T's relative to the collection of evidence and the preservation of evidence. And bear in mind, when you go and you want to take someone's liberty away, or even in some states where they still have, the capital offense, you can be the death penalty. You know, there has to be no doubt whatsoever. And, you know, contrast that with the result a couple years later where he was convicted, he was found guilty in a civil case and with 20 some odd million dollars assessed against him. So that's the difference in the burden of proof. So if you want to take away someone's liberty, you want to give them the death penalty, you must prove beyond a reasonable doubt.
Right.
And it was very clear from the examination of the evidence. I mean, look, the lead investigator, Furman, took the Fifth Amendment.
Yes.
You'll recall.
Yep. I remember that. Would you ever have had O.J. try on those gloves if you were working on the prosecution team?
Well, not unless I knew they'd fit.
Right.
You know, I mean, there's a cliche in trial practice that says you never ask a question on cross-examination to which you don't already know the answer, okay? And the same would be true with that kind of demonstration. You never do a demonstration unless you know it's going to work the way you want it to.
Right. Bob Clifford, Attorney Bob Clifford, thank you for coming on. Now you can go to bed. And by the way, we finally had a chance to meet about a month ago at Chicago Cut Steakhouse, and it's really nice to meet you in person.
Well, that's very kind of you to say. You know, it's not that late at night, but as I told you at the beginning of our call, I just flew in from Europe. I represent families in the crash of the Ethiopian Airlines in March of this year, the Boeing case, the 737 case, and you're going to see a lot unfold about that over the months ahead. It's a terrible tragedy, and that one, too, is going to captivate the nation and the world because aviation is common to all of us around this globe.
Right. Attorney Bob Clifford. Bob, we'll have you back on to talk about that, too. Have a great night. Thank you so much.
You too, Pete. Thank you.
Take care.
Bye.
It's 720 WGN. 720 WGN. Pete McMurray in the Allstate Skyline Studios. The former Stanford sailing coach. He dodged prison time in the Varsity Blues college entrance scandal. Joining us, he's been covering the story. It's Aaron Katursky from ABC News. Aaron, you think Lori Loughlin is rethinking her innocent plea?
Well, look, I think that there's a potential here for some defendants to say, he skirted prison time, just got a 2-year supervised release sentence. Maybe I can do the same. Problem, though, is the judge said that Vandemore's case was rather unique. She said that he was among the least culpable of the 50 defendants charged in the scheme. And there are certainly others who may have played a more prominent role who judges could decide deserve a more stiff sentence.
John Vandemore is Stanford's former sailing coach. Aaron, tell us about his sentencing.
Yeah, time served after his arrest, and he had also been given 2 years supervised release, has to pay a $10,000 fine. And that's just a fraction of the bribe money that prosecutors said he took in exchange for arranging athletic profiles for students, including a Chinese woman whose family paid the scheme's mastermind $6.5 million, by far the largest amount charged in the scheme. And Vandermeer never kept the money for himself, and this is what may have saved him prison time. He just kind of reinvested it into the Stanford sailing program, and so the judge said that he deserved no prison time. Prosecutors fought it, though. They fought hard. They thought that as the first defendant sentenced after pleading guilty, there should have been some prison time to send a message. And they read letters from high school kids worried about the college admission system being rigged, and they argued for more than a slap on the wrist.
$6.5 million these parents gave this guy. Why wouldn't they just donate that to the school? And the school would say, all right, we'll let your kid in.
It's like the old-fashioned way, right? And you could say that about any of these defendants. I mean, in the case of the Chinese family, they're not charged in the scheme, so you wonder if maybe they just didn't quite understand how it all worked. But you look at Lori Loughlin and her husband, they're charged with paying $500,000 to get their girls into USC. And you do wonder, given her notoriety, whether there may have been a different way to perhaps go about this. But nonetheless, they're charged. She has pleaded not guilty and is presumably fighting the charges still. Somebody like a Felicity Huffman is set to be sentenced in the coming weeks. Her amount of fraud, though, isn't so much. She also could avoid jail time.
So Felicity Huffman was charged. William H. Macy was not.
And we're not quite sure why that is, because he is mentioned, not by name, but by, her husband. And we know who her husband is.
Right.
And you wonder why he wasn't charged. And it may just have been that the amount of fraud wasn't big enough to bother with yet another bold-faced name. You just don't know. But Felicity Huffman, I think, took any possibility of him being charged off the table when she agreed to plead guilty to paying $15,000 to get her daughter into school.
We're talking about the Varsity Blues college entrance scandal. Aaron Katursky from ABC News is joining us. In my opinion, Felicity Huffman did everything right. She pled guilty. She said she was ashamed. She apologized. Does the court of public opinion help at all in this case with her?
I think in a way it does. The demeanor, the, saying nothing, Lauren Loughlin was seen signing autographs, and smiling to fans on her way into court. That's not something that anyone's going to look terribly kindly on.
Right.
But Felicity Huffman seems to have gotten the message. But look, people go about this different ways. And really what matters is the amount of fraud. $15,000 is on the low end of what's been charged in the scheme.
Right.
$500,000. is on the higher end. There's much more exposure for Loughlin.
I don't mean to laugh, but Lori Loughlin and her husband, Massimino, the designer, I don't get why they pled not guilty. I just don't get it.
The legal strategy isn't clear to me either, given that they're, according to court records, on tape discussing a bribe payment.
You paid off someone. That's what I don't understand about Lori Loughlin. The mastermind, Rick Singer, worked with the feds for months. They have recordings. They have bribe money that exchanged hands. She is guilty.
It's hard to see her defense, if that's the route she goes, being successful. But, you never know what happens if you take your chances in front of a jury.
Besides these celebrities, there are many other wealthy people involved in this scandal. 20, 25 parents. How many parents?
You've got about, I think it's close to 30 parents.
30 parents.
Half of them have pleaded guilty. Another half are taking their chances before, a trial, assuming it does get that far, and they don't change their mind. But they are wealthy. They are CEOs. They are philanthropists. They are, they do run the gamut. And the commonality seems to have been that they had the means to try and rig the system. And the scheme's mastermind, Rick Singer, who was caught early and agreed to cooperate against all these people,
right,
has said that he did this 800 different times in the last few decades. So there are many more parents who perhaps could be charged that aren't. But prosecutors said they are still not done investigating this.
That's what I don't understand about Lori Loughlin. And when does Lori go back to court? It's sometime in October, right?
That's right. Her case is in court, but she doesn't have to appear again. And, you don't know. This could obviously change depending on once the defense has a look at some of the evidence during the discovery period and they realize that, they actually did the rights. But on the other hand, she may feel like she has a solid case or a solid defense if, in fact, she was duped into thinking that what she was doing was wrong or didn't realize that it was a crime. not knowing something is a crime isn't usually a successful defense, but
right.
So let's see where she does.
I don't know what it is. Is it the celebrity in this story, or is it the college thing? Because we all can relate because we have kids.
I think that's reflected in letters that prosecutors have received that they read to the court during the sentencing of Vandemore. That, you know, kids from all over the country are writing in saying that they believe the system of college entry is rigged, and they believe that, you know, their fair play is often at stake. And
yeah.
So I think that's what it's the celebrity may have kept it in the news, but who doesn't have a kid who has gone or will go through the process? And you kind of always wonder in the back of your head whether it's on the up and up. And this story seemed to confirm people's worst suspicions that, at least in these cases, it wasn't.
I could name off three people I went to school with whose parents are wealthy that donated to the school, and I'm positive that's how they got in.
And for every, and prosecutors made this clear, for every kid whose parents are charged in this scheme that did get in through a bribe payment, that's a spot that didn't go to somebody who was perhaps much more deserving.
Right.
And for prosecutors, you know, that's why it is not a victimless scheme.
So we're going to see Felicity Huffman in court when? In the next 30 days?
No, she's, I forget her exact date, but I think in the coming weeks, she's set to be sentenced. And given the amount of fraud and what prosecutors are recommending, you could see a judge finding his or her way to sentencing her to maybe probation or something that would keep her out of prison. That's what she's hoping for. Prosecutors say they'd recommend a sentence that's, you know, less than 6 months.
Right. Aaron Katursky from ABC News. Thanks for coming on, man. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Pete.
All right. Take care. 720 WGN. 312-981-7200 is our phone number, also our text line. Pete McMurray in the Allstate Skyline Studios just before midnight, Thursday nights, talking about the college admissions scandal, Varsity Blues. There was people that you went to high school with that didn't deserve to go to that college. I mean, come on, everybody think back. I know of three in my class, a one guy specifically that went to Notre Dame who wasn't very bright. And that's the only reason he got in. And to this day, when I talk to him, it's like, how did you ever graduate from Notre Dame? How did that happen? Mm-hmm. Where'd you go to college?
Columbia, downtown.
Okay, where'd you go to high school? You knew, in your senior class, Vivi, there had to be some people.
I really can't think of... I mean, look, I can sit here and think about people that could seem to be one of those people you're talking about,
mm-hmm.
but I can't... I mean, I don't know of a case.
Do you know people that have contributed that for their kids to get them in school?
I don't know.
I grew up...
I can research. I can become a private investigator.
No. I mean, just off the top of your head, because I know people. I mean, we live in Chicago. There's people that give to schools, so they get their... That's what I don't understand about Lori Loughlin. Why not donate to the school? Why would you go through a middleman? I don't... And I just don't understand why she pled not guilty. They have you on tape, giving the money. The middleman worked with the FBI. You're busted. I just don't get it. But she's going to drag this out, and then there's probably going to be a plea deal. But I went to Bradley, and I worked my butt off to get in that school. However, my father went to Bradley, my brother Ed went to Bradley, my brother Steve went to Bradley, and my sister Mary went to Bradley. So I had four ahead of me. There was a legacy thing in there where they were going to let me in.
Wow, it's impressive.
And knowing me as you do now, I was the fifth McMurray to graduate from Bradley. So right before graduation, I called up the school newspaper and I said, hey, listen, I'm the fifth McMurray. You should get a picture with me and my father. And they put us on the front page of the Hill Topics.
Oh, that's so awesome.
Oh, thank you very much. You got to make your own press. You really do.
You're smart.
This week, are you a Bear fan?
I am.
Do you know who number 10 is for the Chicago Bears?
Yes, I do.
He throws passes for us.
He's
our quarterback.
Mitch Trubisky.
Do you know, what is it with people? They can't pronounce his last name. Mitch Trubisky. The biscuit. It's Mitch Trubisky.
I'm sorry, Mitch.
I am a very lucky person.
I luck out, okay? And for some reason, people invite me to different things. And somehow this week, I was invited to an event where Bears quarterback number 10, Mitch Trubisky, was there. And he was speaking to a room full of people, and somehow I managed to get in a back room where he was signing things, and I just started talking to him, and I turned on my phone. If you follow me on Instagram, and I hope you do because I want more followers than my friend Jane Manzouras, at Pete McMurray, I posted this video this afternoon. So do we have the audio?
Yes, we do.
This is Mitch Trubisky. It's about 45 seconds, me talking to Mitch. Go ahead.
I'm a season ticket holder for the Bears. The first game of the season, of course, is against the Packers. How much does that mean to you?
It means a lot. We're excited. It's going to be a big game for us. We're going to start the season out right. It means a lot that it's the 100th year of the Bears franchise, and we also get to start against our rival on Thursday Night Football for the whole country. So we're excited.
I mean, you couldn't ask for more than that. How do you not get pumped up? That's unbelievable.
You do get pumped up.
Right.
That's the whole point.
Yeah. By the way, I'm in section 251, north end zone, above the time clock. And after you throw that touchdown pass to go up 7-0, can you just point up there at me?
Yeah. I'll give you a nice little point.
I like it. Thanks, buddy.
Yeah.
It's our quarterback.
That's our quarterback, Mitch Trubisky. And I do have to say, he was in that room for about 30 minutes. He couldn't have been more of a gentleman. He thanked his offensive line twice. He said how much he loves his family. He's finishing school because he wants to make his mother proud. Everything that he said was positive.
Oh, that's so nice.
I've worked events with Jay Cutler in the past, and I don't mean to compare, but this guy is the real deal. And they say it takes 3 or 4 years for a quarterback just to get used to the NFL. This is his third year. Hopefully something big's going to happen. God, I have high expectations for the Bears. I'm just getting psyched just talking about it right now.
I can see your face.
Oh, I love it.
And why wouldn't you?
Oh.
They deserve it. Look what they've done. No, they've.
My son he turns 14 in July. He hasn't seen a good Bears team until last year. Think about it. He was a baby when they went to the Super Bowl. He doesn't remember that. And we stunk. So I would go to Bear games, and I'd tailgate in the South lot with my brothers, and my son would stay at home, and he would watch the Packers with my wife. And the Packers, of course, have Aaron Rodgers. So what kind of jersey is he going to wear over the years? And now I bought him a Trubisky jersey. Finally, we have a good team.
God. I know. My throat's still sore from when Devin Hester was returning things for touchdowns.
I'll never forget that. I'll never forget it. My brother was texting me. He was at the game, my brother Dave. And it was like, it was it. It was like destiny when he ran back that touchdown on the first kickoff. And then it
You're
was
talking
all,
about the Super Bowl? Or?
Yes.
Oh, I remember
and it was
that.
All downhill
yeah.
after that. That was rough stuff, that Super Bowl.
I was in a bar in the Caribbean. I was the only Bears fan in that bar going for them when he did that. And I thought, that's it. We're going to take him.
Right.
And just things started going down.
And then it started raining sideways. And then Peyton Manning figured a few things out and we lost. But this is going to be a great year. And I'm telling you, I was so impressed with Mitch Trubisky. And again, if you want to watch the video portion, just go to my Instagram at Pete McMurray. All right, it's 720 WGN. Anybody by chance hear House Smarts Radio last Saturday?
Mm-mm.
Anybody? No one on the show? Listen to House Smarts Radio last Saturday morning.
I did not.
Because I hosted it.
Oh.
I did.
I didn't know that.
Sorry, Pete.
I listen to Lou Manfredini every single Saturday morning, and he's in Alaska hanging out, and he said, would you like to host? And I said, absolutely. Who's the expert that you have in? Because I can't fix anything to save my life. So I hosted with Mike Holmes, who is a contractor, and it was great.
That's awesome.
And I take notes. I listen every week, and it was fun just being in there. But House Smarts Radio, Lou Manfredini, every Saturday morning at 7 a.m. Coming up after top of the hour, there was a guy that grew up memorizing scenes in movies. This was his deal. Thought it would be fun to memorize scenes. He used it as a bar trick. Then he turned it into a website. And now, 20 years later, he's turned it into an empire. And he's got a brand new book out called Being Mr. Skin. We will talk to him right after the top of the hour news. Again, our phone number, 312-981-7200.
Mr. Skin,
720 WGN, I'm Pete McMurray in the Allstate Skyline Studios. Our next guest I met in the late 90s, and he's become a great friend. He grew up memorizing nude scenes in movies. Yes, he started watching movies, recorded them for his buddies, and then started memorizing them for fun. Well, fast forward 20 plus years later, he has an empire at MrSkin.com and a brand new autobiography called Being Mr. Skin. It's Mr. Skin, Jim McBride. How are you, buddy?
Doing great, Pete. And I got to say, you were very skinspirational for me as far as my career, because you were one of the first people to ever have me on the radio in Chicago, where you used to have people call in and ask me questions, and we got to know each other really well. And from there, you know, I went on the Steve Dahl show and then radio shows all over the country, and it was a big part of the success of MrSkin.com and being able to do this for 20 years. So you were there at the very beginning, and I really appreciate that.
Back when we were all wearing Hawaiian shirts in the late 90s.
Oh, yeah. There's some pictures in this book of those days, and it's not a pretty sight.
Well, take me back to the days. You're a Chicago guy. You grew up in Oak Park. Take me back to the days with your first VCR and when you got HBO.
Yeah, well, as a kid, I grew up watching ABC, CBS, and NBC, which meant zero nude scenes. And as a coming-of-age young man, it was just so, you know, people today can't understand that there wasn't an internet or that you couldn't go on your phone.
Right.
There was this, like, convergence of technologies. The sky, I joke about, the skies opened up, and my dad got me a cable television in suburban River Forest, Illinois, and he got me a Betamax at the same time, and I went from, you know, never being able to see a nude scene to being a teenager, and all of a sudden I had HBO, Showtime, and Cinemax with these drive-in movies from the 70s. I just was in heaven. I couldn't believe that this world existed, and I just recorded everything I could and edited the nude scenes onto other tapes. I collected it like people collect baseball cards or stamps or something. I collected nude scenes and became a real expert on the subject, and my friends used to love to come over and watch the tapes, but also quiz me whenever throughout the 80s and 90s. That was a fun party trick, and that's kind of how this whole thing started.
So you go to college, and then you graduate college, and you work at the Merck, and that's where it kind of turned into a thing. What did you do at the Merck? You worked on the floor, right?
Yeah, I was in the Eurodollar pit all through the 90s, and I was a clerk. I wasn't a broker. I wasn't a runner. A clerk is someone who watches desks and then puts the orders into the you know, into the pits. Well, you know, I talk about this in the book where, you know, I wasn't the greatest clerk during fast markets when things were really flying, but when times were slow, which there were a lot of downtime when no trades were being made and it was just thousands of guys standing around like one big locker room, that's when I shined at the Merck, because all the brokers knew there was this guy in this clerk that if you asked them any actress, he could tell you off the top of his head whether an actress had been nude. So runners would come up to me and have little notes, like, you know, for example, when Mad About You had started, Helen Hunt and Paul Reiser's show, someone in the 90s might say, hey, has Helen Hunt ever done a nude scene? And they'd have a runner come up, and I'd look on the card, and I'd write down, oh, yeah, she did a movie, The Water Dance, and, you know, she was naked at the 36-minute mark, da-da-da. And then he'd go, and then I might say a joke like, yeah, and it's guaranteed to give you a riser. And then all of a sudden, she'd walk into the pit, it'd be really quiet, and all the guys would get a big laugh, and it was a great way for me to hone my skills. I just wasn't really planning on honing it for a career. I was just doing it for fun.
You had no idea at this point that this was going to turn into an empire.
No idea. And even when the day came, I was in a bar that people might remember in Chicago called Charlie's Ale House, and I had to get up real early the next day to be on the floor of the Merck, and we were just having some beers, and my friends were quizzing me on actresses in like 96 or so, and it just so happened Harry Tynowitz was standing there, and I had never met him before, and he couldn't believe I knew this off the top of my head, so he invited me on to his radio show, and I was hesitant at first, It took him a few weeks to get me to do it, but I said, I'll do it if I don't use my real name. And he goes, that's fine. And he said, well, how about Mr. Naked? And I said, that's really creepy.
It sounds
weird.
Well,
how about Mr. Skin? How about Mr. Skin? And on his second try, you know, I did it. And I went on the show, and I remember, you know, I was nervous. I'd never even called into a radio show, but they, you know, had me, a bunch of people called in. I nailed every question, and I loved it. I really had a great time, but I remember thinking, that's my 15 minutes of fame. That was a cool thing, but I had my 15 minutes, now back to the Merc. And as I was leaving, his, you know, his producer tapped me on the shoulder and said, you know, we had so many people that wanted to ask you questions. Would you want to come back and do this again? And I remember thinking at the time, wow, I really have something. I just didn't know what I had, you know.
Right. So we're talking with Mr. Skin, Jim McBride. His book is called Being Mr. Skin. Now, this is so Chicago. I met you in 98, right when I moved to Chicago. Harry Tynowitz and I worked together for 3 months back in 98. We did a show called Radio for Men on WCKG. Harry went back to ESPN after 90 days, but the show was on from 7 to 11 at night. We would go to the lodge almost every night after the show because I lived a block away. Now, you worked at the Merc at the time. I met you. I want to say it was like 1 in the morning. We're hanging out till 3, and I'm like, do you have a real job? And you said, yeah, I work at the Merc. And I said, what time do you have to go to work?
I know. I had to be up at 6 in the morning. But, you know,
right.
I was a single guy. I was in my 30s. I didn't have, you know, didn't have a lot of obligations. And I often lie awake at night thinking, thank God I went out that night to Charlie's Ale House, or I probably this thing never would have happened. You know, it was just a weird circumstance to be able to get to do this for 20 years. It really was.
Right. Well, let's talk about how this thing blew up. So you started doing a radio show. A guy heard you and said, hey, would you like to start a website?
Yeah. So I became a little bit of a, you know, Chicago radio celebrity, Tiny, in that I was on a lot of shows like Dahl and yours and a couple others, and people in Chicago knew who I was. So when they would have radio events like at WCKG, I would be at a lot of them. And at one of the events, I was actually umpiring one of Steve Dahl's celebrity softball games, and it was being broadcast by you on the radio. Literally, I umpired the game. I was getting ready to leave. It was a weeknight, like a Thursday, and I had to get to work early the next morning. But some guy was in the stands, and he walked up to me after the game and said, you know, you have to put what's in your head into a website. And I said, well, what's a website? I didn't even know. This was like 1997.
No one knew what it was.
No, I didn't know. And
no.
He said, no, there's opportunity for you to really make money. So he talked me into it, and I actually quit my job, raised some money from my brother-in-law and a broker at the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. Not a lot of money. And I, you know, took this chance. And I remember thinking, if I could just make a couple of extra bucks, I'm not really happy down here at the Merc. I'm not going anywhere. I'll find another job. But, you know, this will be fun. And here we are 20 years later. I launched the site on August 10th of 1999. With really very low expectations, but you know, here we are 20 years later. I have 40 people that work for me, and when I take a step back and look at this thing, I think the biggest thing that stands out, yes, the website has been very successful, but it's just that I've had so much fun. What a great thing to do for 20 years when you could have a job that is just nonstop fun, you know?
Right. It's all yucks. We're talking with Mr. Skin. Being Mr. Skin is his book. Now, when you started the website, by the way, we were going out 3 or 4 nights a week, and then suddenly you disappeared for a year. That's when you put the website together.
Yeah, I was sitting in a studio apartment at 10 East Ontario in Chicago, and I literally was working 18-hour days and just putting the database together. I told my team of one developer and one marketing guy, I said, listen, I'm not going to launch this till I have the skinformation on 1,000 actresses, because if it's going to be a pay site, I want people to have enough content where they're going to stick around longer than, you know, one day. And that was my goal, and it took a long time because I did everything from the website thing. Now I have people that do it all for me, but at that time I did everything, including
right.
having to go through the movie and grab the pics and clips and write the reviews and get biopics for the actresses and put in all their statistics, their date of birth, and all that other stuff. That I was very numbers oriented. But yeah, it was, you know, when I launched it, you know, I literally within 5 minutes of launching, flipping the switch, we had our first join. I thought this was going to be so easy, but it took a good 6 months to get going in the big break, and I talk about it in the book. One of my skin-finding moments was getting on the Howard Stern show to promote the website, and that really blew things up.
It's one thing to get on Howard, but when Howard embraces you and truly likes you, I mean, that's huge.
Yeah, and people tell me that all the time because I've been a guest on the Howard Stern show probably 25 times in studio. That very first time I went on, I just called in, but since then I've been in studio, you know, 24, 25 times. But you're right. You just cannot imagine how many people listen to that show. And when Howard likes what you do and even talks about it when I'm not a guest on the show, that free publicity, I can't even imagine what that meant to me over the course of the years of running this business.
Sure. And let's talk about Knocked Up. Judd Apatow, who did 40-Year-Old Virgin, was writing a new movie. He contacts you and says what?
Well, it was actually lawyers from Universal contacted me. That movie came out on June 1st of 2007, Knocked Up, and it was the summer of 06. I get a call from a Universal attorney, and he says to me that, you know, the guy that did 40-Year-Old Virgin wants to put your website into his next movie. And, you know, I had a lot of people telling me, hey, listen, you got to charge them some serious money. You got to do this. You got to do that. And I'm not the greatest businessman in the world, but I did instinctively know that why put up roadblocks or why do anything that would make them change course, and why make it tough for them to get your website. And I just knew, good or bad, how they treated the website, that the publicity would be fantastic.
Right.
That 40-Year-Old Virgin was a big hit. So I just said, where do I sign? Do whatever you want. And I got to say, the product placement of MrSkin.com in the movie Knocked Up is right up there with Reese's Pieces in E.T. It was just an amazing, amazing product placement.
Well, explain to people if they don't remember the scene in the movie. It's Paul Rudd, right?
Yeah, well, there's a couple things. One is the scene where Paul Rudd and Seth Rogen are talking about, you know, what Seth Rogen is trying to do. And by the way, Judd Apatow heard me on the Howard Stern show while he was writing the screenplay for Knocked Up, and he was trying to come up with a really embarrassing job, but also a funny job for Seth Rogen.
Right.
And he thought of what I did, which is funny in itself. But no, and then Seth Rogen's explaining that he's trying to do this celebrity website, and Paul Rudd goes, what, you mean like Mr. Skin? And he goes, what's that? And they flash to the boys all standing around a computer. They've been working over a year on this website and realize that MrSkin.com exists and that they have no chance of beating it, so they all quit making the website.
God, I love it. We're talking with Mr. Skin, celebrating 20 years with his new book, Being Mr. Skin. You do interviews all the time from your house in the northern burbs. You have three kids, one in high school, two in grammar school. How do you juggle being Mr. Skin and being a dad?
Yeah, you know, it's funny, and I try to bring up some stories in the book because one of the weird things for me is I'll be at a wedding or I'll be at, you know, even a funeral or something, and guys just feel like they could come up and ask me anything anytime. Like, I'll be at a funeral and someone will be like, you know, hey, I just saw that movie Gone Girl. Yeah, you know, what the, who was that girl that got naked in it, you know, at a funeral or something? And it happens all the time. I think from my kid's standpoint, I think maybe for the girls it might be a little embarrassing, but
yes.
I got to say, my son, his baseball team, I know all the guys on the baseball team, they all want Mr. Skin swag, so it's not so bad for him, I guess.
Now, Mr. Skin, your website has been mentioned on SNL, Family Guy, the People's Choice Awards, Jimmy Kimmel has mentioned it. You get movies from major studios and TV shows now, don't you?
Yeah, well, you know, we get 6 million visitors a month to MrSkin.com, and many movie studios and PR firms send us screeners of, you know, movies or television shows so we could review them and talk about them. And listen, there's a lot of competition out there, and if we're at MrSkin.com celebrating a show, you know, for great nudity, that it's great free publicity for them. I just saw that HBO has a show called Euphoria that's starting this weekend that I think is going to blow people's minds with how much sex and nudity you're going to see. And that's something we'll be talking about a lot this year, and it's great publicity for the show.
And I do have to mention before we go, your wife Michelle, she is a rock star.
Oh, well, thank you. I'm very lucky, and she's been with me since day one. In fact, another reason you've been very important in my life is I was at your one-year anniversary show as a guest with Cindy Crawford's mom. A big lineup you had.
That was a big lineup. Mr. Skin and Cindy Crawford's mom, everybody.
That was the night.
Come on out to the Abbey Pub.
Yeah, at the Abbey Pub. I actually met my wife that night, and we have video and pictures of me the first time I laid eyes on her, which is really a cool thing to have.
She's an attorney by trade, a great mother, but also has done so much charity work in California, in Chicago, everywhere. That's what your wife is all about.
Yeah, no, she's a great person. I'm very lucky, and you have a lot to do with it, so I want to thank you.
Does she still laugh with the skinisms when you bring them up?
Yeah, not as much. I think the family gets a little, I can't help it.
I
puns and things like that, I just can't help it. And, you know, it's a big part of my website. It's a big part of this book. And it's unfortunately, in some cases, a big part of my life. So,
well, congratulations on 20 years. The book is called Being Mr. Skin. You can get it at Amazon and anywhere else. It's Jim McBride, Mr. Skin. Thanks for coming on, buddy.
You're awesome, Pete. Thanks so much.
All right. It's 720 WGN. Pete McMurray in the Allstate Skyline Studios. Thanks again to Mr. Skin. He brought up a new show called Euphoria on HBO. I've never even heard of it, and I just looked it up during commercials. Created by Sam Levinson, the son of Rain Man director Barry. Euphoria has tons of nudity in it. So if you like Game of Thrones, this is the show for you. Starts this Sunday. Male full frontal nudity on Sunday's show.
Fun.
Full female, full frontal on Sunday's show. It's dirty. It's a dirty show. What are you watching right now? You don't watch mainstream shows.
I don't.
Vic doesn't watch any TV whatsoever. What are you watching? What are you watching in your spare time? You going to Netflix? What are you doing?
Well, you know what? I just started watching the Ted Bundy documentary.
On Netflix.
There's only four episodes, though. So
I know.
It
it's
really
a
count.
Little depressing for me, though.
I know. But I like that. I like watching documentaries.
The documentaries, sometimes they go on too long.
This is just four episodes, though.
Like the Fire Festival, did you watch that?
I did.
That
yeah,
was
I
one
did.
Episode. It was perfect.
Yeah, that was good.
That's what I liked about it.
That
just give
crazy.
Me one episode. Ted Bundy, good looking guy.
Really? Wait a second.
Yes.
Did you really think that he was a good looking guy?
A lot of people thought he was a good looking guy.
Because I did not. No.
Really?
No, yeah. I mean, Zac Efron playing him is beautiful. But
he is a good-looking man, Zac Efron.
Yes, absolutely. But Ted Bundy, not really. I'm sorry.
I know, four episodes. I don't know if I can get through it. How about Billions? Did you watch that on Showtime?
Just a couple of episodes, actually. I remember we had Morrow on the show, right?
Rob Morrow?
Yeah.
Yeah, who plays the federal judge in there.
That's right.
Now Chuck is going after Bobby Axelrod. The thing with Billions, they changed the storyline where they don't even really explain it. Why did Bobby and Chuck suddenly become rivals again? And now Chuck wants to take Bobby down. That was the season finale. Don't really understand it. Big Little Lies started on HBO. Meryl Streep plays the dead husband's mother this season. She was good on Sunday. She is great in everything she does. Every single thing she does, she's fantastic. Meryl Streep. Big Little Lies. Nicole Kidman, Reese Witherspoon, Laura Dern, Zoe Kravitz, Charlene Woodley. Sunday's episode was okay. You got to give it some time, though.
Did you watch Game of Thrones?
I did not. I think I'm the only one on the planet besides you.
No.
I don't know. I never really jumped into it.
Yeah, neither did I. I just watched the last episode.
And then, like, season five, people are like, I can't believe you're not watching Game of Thrones.
I'm like, I don't know. Such an outsider.
it just seemed so weird when it started. There's like, you know, it's like the dragons and the whole deal. I just, it didn't really interest me. I love Billions because, you know, you got a hedge fund guy and he's rich and, you know, Big Little Lies about a murder mystery. All right. I can take that. Game of Thrones. Maybe down the road. But, you know, I don't have time. Time is precious.
It's true.
Yeah. So that's it. That's all you're watching on Netflix?
Yes. And there's another one that I started a couple of months ago. It's Blank Creek. Can't say the first part.
With Chris Elliott.
Yes.
It's a comedy. It's 30 minutes, isn't it?
Yes.
I've heard great things about
that. It's so good. It's so funny.
Because that's their last name, right? Is that why you can't say it?
Yes, exactly.
That's their last name on the show.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
How many seasons in?
Oh, this, two.
Okay, good. So I can catch up.
Yeah, catch up, Pete.
I like the 30-minute ones.
This is short. It's like 24 minutes.
Fantastic.
Yeah, it's great.
That's
witty,
my speed right there.
It's fun. It's sarcastic. It's,
right.
It's great. You'd love it, actually. Honestly, you'd love it.
I got to write that down.
Yeah.
That was one of the things on my list. There's, you know, when you're trying to get after everything, it's tough.
I know.
312-981-7200 is our phone number. We'll check news in just a second. And then we have a question for you. We have a question. I don't think anyone's going to get it. You know what? I'm going to throw it out there right now. 312-981-7200. If someone can get it correct, we're going to set you up with a Lou Malnati's gift certificate. Okay? Are you ready for it?
I'm ready.
Here is the question. What is the secret of happiness? What is the secret of happiness? Boston University just did a study and found the secret of happiness.
I think I got it.
What I got it too.
312-981-7200. If you get it correct, we'll set you up with a Lou Malnati's gift certificate. But first, let's take a look at news. Vic? My guys, Greta Van Fleet. I love them. Pete McMurray in the Allstate Skyline Studios. 312-981-7200 is our phone number. What is the key to happiness? What is the key to happiness? Let's start with Vic. Vic?
I think the key to happiness is I read this the other day. Contemplating your own mortality at least three times a day will make you a happier person. That was a study.
No, that is incorrect.
I'm very glad you said that, actually.
Correct.
Because that would have really stunk if I would have just taken all the
And if my computer just didn't go down, I would give you a buzzer. But that is completely incorrect. No. Viv?
You know, George is listening right now.
Your boyfriend.
I want to say George Gabriel.
You have to remind people who George is.
I'm sorry.
He's your boyfriend. So
correct.
George is your key to happiness.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, that's nice.
Not the answer
Isn't
I was looking
nice,
for.
Vic?
That is nice.
A Greek girl dating a guy named George. Wow. Welcome to Chicago. Pam in Evanston. Pam, what is the key to happiness?
I think the key to happiness is being around other happy people.
That is absolutely right.
Yay.
Being around happy people.
Makes perfect sense, actually.
Yes.
It does.
It does. Where are you calling? You're calling from Evanston? Hold on. We're going to set you up with Lou Malnati's gift certificate.
Thank
Lou Malnati's is home of Chicago's best deep dish pizza.
Much.
Find one of their 40-plus Chicagoland locations or order online at loumalnati's.com. I ordered from the one at Lincoln and Montrose on Sunday. We had four pies delivered to my house.
And you were happy.
For a graduation party. People were happy. Pam, who do you surround yourself with? Who are the happy people?
People that I work with. And I also try to be a happy person, you know, to make their life happier.
Right. What do you do with negative people when they hang out in your life? What are you doing?
In all honesty, I kind of give myself my own messages, you know, not to be influenced by their negative behavior.
Right.
It's just, you know, it's sad when people are negative or always down about other people. So
I got sucked in today. There was two women that I work with on some side projects, and they just went after me today. And it usually doesn't bother me, and I've been carrying it with me all day. And I was driving to work, and I started playing some music, and I thought to myself, why does this bother me so much? You just got to let it go. Because they probably had some problems, and they projected it on me, and I thought, okay, got to go to happy people.
Yeah, it's easier said than done to just let it go.
You're right. You're right.
But you do have to just give yourself more positive messages, though, I think.
Well, I come to work, and Vivi couldn't be the... You're the happiest person on the planet.
I know.
Well, I know.
Thanks.
Thank you for that. Yes. Yeah. Pam, hold on. We'll get all your
Thank
information.
You.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Vic, are you a happy guy? You seem pretty happy.
Yeah. Yeah, I definitely am. Now, you only get one life, man. Why are you going to walk around... peed off all the time.
Well, before the show, I noticed something about you because I always see you on a monitor because you're down the hall.
Yeah.
You've lost a ton of weight.
205 to 175 now, but I got to stop it there. I got to get in the gym. I got to get a few muscles.
You look great. Too skinny. That is awesome, this is the best Vic. You've ever looked.
Oh, thanks, man. And at 48 almost, you got to, I noticed, man, I started getting this tire around my midsection, and I was like, whoa, I've never had to watch what I eat before. And so now, yeah, got to get in the gym.
Once you hit 45, you got to ditch that weight or you're going to carry it for a while.
Yep, and you know what? I didn't really mind the weight, to be honest with you. I really didn't care because I'm in a happy relationship. But the back pain, I started to get this back pain for the first time in my life. So I cut out all, just temporarily, milk, dairy, and just junk food. I don't eat any processed food now.
Really?
But I got to get in the gym, lift some weights with you, man. I know you're in there pumping weights every day.
I'm not at pumping weights every day. I'm a guy that comes from a family that loves food. And unfortunately, I have my father's side of the family. That means my dad's weight fluctuated like Elvis. He was always on a diet growing up, and it was just terrible. So I have to work out all the time. So
you know, that probably makes you happy too. Working out, I've heard, you know, it releases a lot of chemicals that just are going to boost your positivity. Mm-hmm.
Vic, they're called endorphins. You go to the gym, you need some of those.
Yeah, those. I need to get some of those.
Do you guys have any negative people in your life? I brought up those two women today that just laid into me. And I'm not kidding. They laid into me. Yeah. Wow.
I'm sorry,
I know I got to get past it, but... the negative people. Do you have any negative people that you're trying to cut out of your life?
I honestly try to stay away from negative people.
What if you had a family member that was a negative Nelly?
I would try to avoid them.
Yeah.
I mean...
In some way, I don't know how.
If it's a sibling, I mean, you're going to still see him around the holidays.
Vic is like, yep.
Sorry, you're cut out. If you're not happy or not.
Not coming by you.
And I'm not joking at all. I really agree. Pam, this caller, I'd like to... know more about Pam. She seems like she's got life figured out. That, she's right, though. You know, negative people around you. You gotta get rid of those people and just stick with a good nucleus of positive people.
The study at Boston University, they interviewed almost 5,000 people. The key to happiness is hanging around happy people. Now, that seems so easy, but sometimes we don't do that. Why is that? If you want to be happy, surround yourself with happy people. Yeah. The study even showed that living within a mile of a friend who is happy has a 25% chance of making you happier. Do you guys live around happy friends?
I can see that. Yeah.
You got friends that you live around?
Yeah. I can see that. Even growing up.
I do too. Well, that's why it's so great to have fun neighbors too.
Yeah.
Because that'll make you happy when you see your neighbors. Huh. Surrounding yourself with people who lift you up rather than drag you down. You are the average of the five people you spend the most time with.
Mm-hmm.
Think about that for a second. You are the average of the five people you spend the most time with. So think about the five people that you're with. You got to count your spouse or your boyfriend
mm-hmm.
or your girlfriend. Are they downers? Because some people are. I dated a Debbie Downer. It didn't last very long.
No, but I can't see you with a Debbie Downer.
I did. Absolutely. Think about if you got a negative spouse.
Yeah,
that's
going to
drag you down,
man.
That's
going to be bad.
The key is to stop and think about the people you spend the most time with. Makes sense. Ask yourself four key questions when considering hanging out with these people. Are you ready?
Yeah, I'm ready.
Okay. Here are the four questions. You know what? I'm going to take a break. That's a quick teaser. That's a quick teaser. We're going to go through this. The key to happiness is surrounding yourself with happy people. Okay? When you're surrounding yourself, you got to ask yourself four key questions. We'll talk about those next on 720 WGN. Because I'm happy. Clap along if you feel like a room without a roof. Because I'm happy. Clap along. 720 WGN, Pete McMurray, Allstate Skyline Studios, talking about the key to happiness. The key to happiness is surrounding yourself with happy people. You are the average of the five people you spend the most time with. That's a huge statement right there. When I read this article and I thought to myself, okay, where are the five people I hang out with? All right. Okay, one of them can go south pretty quick, but they're all pretty happy people. The key is to stop and think about the people you spend the most time with. Ask yourself these four key questions, okay? Everybody ready? Vic, you ready?
Yes, sir.
VV, you ready?
I'm ready.
Number one, do they continually unload their problems on you? Do you have someone that calls you up and, oh, you're not going to believe this. You're not going to believe what happened. We all have people like that. I can think of somebody here at the radio station that does that. Do they unload their problems on you? Number two, are they glass half empty people? Mm. Uh huh.
Mm-hmm.
Number three, do they find ways to be miserable? We all have people in our lives. The only way they can exist is to be miserable or have drama, right?
Right.
Which is too bad because you got to think about something in their childhood. And number four, do they sap your energy? Are they a lot of work to hang out with?
I think we just eliminated.
Well, we're going to have to cut him out.
I'm kidding.
We have a rule in our house. My wife, if we go out with a new couple or if we're at a party, my line is, I don't want to have to babysit them.
Right.
All right? Are they going to be fun? Because I don't want to have to babysit. I just want to have a good time. Are you guys still with me? If you're staring at a bunch of yeses, it's time to cut those people out of your life.
Wait, repeat that?
If you're staring at a bunch of yeses for that... Those four questions. You got to cut those people out.
I support it. Do it.
Vic?
You know, the interesting thing, I think a lot of people... So if you focus on these four questions, do you know someone who unloads their problems on you? Are they glass full or empty people? Mm-hmm. Do they find ways to be miserable? Do they sap your energy, right?
Right.
I think younger people don't realize... I'm going on my own experiences, so it might just be me. But I didn't realize that I really had a choice to decide the circle of people that I was going to allow to be around me until I was, like, into my 30s. My 20s, I just, you know, I mean, whoever was in my life. In other words, you kind of have there's a point in my life where I kind of realized I create my life and how I want it.
Well, that's part of maturing, too. Right. You realize, okay, this person's really bringing me down. Why am I hanging out with them?
I think a lot of it is part of maturity. I think the earlier in life you figure that out, better off you're going to be and the further you'll get.
We had a term when I lived with my brothers. I lived with two of my brothers. Are we going to vote them off the island? Because we're going to quit hanging out with these people. Because
maybe it's good you don't figure it out until later.
In your 20s, you hang out with groups of people. You always go places in groups. At least I did. Maybe it's different for you two.
Good point.
Right.
No, I did a lot more of that in my 20s than I do now, yeah.
And then once you hit 30, it's like, okay, you're in a few relationships, you don't want to hang out with the groups of people anymore, and there's some people in those groups that's a friend of his, and why do I want to hang out with that guy?
I got 4 years till 30, so I'll let you know.
You got 4 years until 30, okay. It's weird how the decades change. In your 20s, you don't really care about anything. 30, you start thinking. In 40, you're like, oh my God, am I saving for retirement?
Mm-hmm. It's so true.
It is. Oh, jeez. Then you have a kid. You got to start thinking, oh man, I'm going down a dark road right now. College fund.
Start resenting the child. Oh, wait.
Well, that's marriage after 10 years. You just start resenting each other.
Hey, come on.
No. Come on. Yes. Back to the study. The key to happiness, of course, is to hang out with happy people. The key with negative people, this is what you do. You have to make them aware that they're being negative. You have to tell them, hey, man, you can't bring your problems over to me anymore. I just can't hear it. What do you got?
Mm-hmm. But what if they need your support?
Challenge their cynicism.
Hmm.
I've done that. I've done that with my wife. Sometimes she likes to unload about work, and I'm like, okay, Sarah. Tell me something that was really great today. What happened? What are you grateful for? What happened today that was great?
That's good.
Because it starts making you think in a positive light. All right, life's not that bad. Yes. So challenge their cynicism. You can challenge their cynical statements and invite them to offer solutions or something positive. It seems so easy, but we don't do it. Why is that?
It's one of those things that is so easy. It's you know what I mean? It really is. It's like saying no. It's really easy to say no, but sometimes it's so hard.
I am reading a book right now. By the way, it takes me forever to read a book. And I can't even remember the name of it because I haven't picked it up in 3 weeks, but I read the first chapter and I loved it. It teaches you the art of saying no, because we're always saying yes. Yes, I can help you. Oh, I'll drop your kid off, or I'll do this duty over here. We're always saying yes to help people. You got to stop saying yes. You got to say no, because you need to regroup with yourself and you can't spread yourself so thin. We're all doing that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
I once read a book. It's called You Can Be Happy No Matter What. That could be one of the books.
Okay.
It's true, though. And, you know, can I throw out a nugget that someone told me, and I've been practicing it for a couple of years now, and it works. Whenever I get, sometimes I just wake up feeling flat, you know, just not a positive mm-hmm. mood. I practice gratitude.
Yeah.
I practice gratitude, and it works every single time. I think about the things I have. Sometimes it's not a lot, but the things I have, I focus on those, whether it's people, don't laugh.
I can't believe really how much you've works. Changed your life around.
What
because
do you mean?
When I met you, you were this fat slob and, you know. No, I mean, I love that. I love what you're saying. And, you know, if people have read the book or have seen the movie, The Secret, that's how it all started, the mm-hmm. whole gratitude thing. Tony Robbins talks about that. Do the priming. Think about things that you're grateful for, what you want to pray for, and three things to thrive. I have a page in my notes, Vic, that I woke up and because I wanted to start doing that again, what I'm grateful for. And I was just writing one thing down, yeah. One thing in the morning and one thing at night.
Nice.
That's awesome.
But then you get busy, and it's been about 2 weeks since I've put some notes into my phone.
Yep.
And you got to keep up with it.
You do.
But there's some days where you just, at least me, I can't get out of it. It's like, okay, just accept it, and you got to go home, and you got to call it a day.
So I guess this is where you rely on those happy, positive people in your life to kind of help you out.
I call it my board of directors. So do you have your people that you call up if you want them to make you happy, or you have to make a major decision in life, and hey, I need your opinion?
Yes.
I need to get one of those.
Well, you have your girlfriend. Can you count on her?
Yes, absolutely, 100%.
So she's one of your board of directors,
yeah.
Right?
George is one of mine, for sure.
Okay, your boyfriend. I got it. My wife is on there. But, you know, we all have... Do you guys have friends?
Yeah.
No. I need to get some dang friends.
Oh, Vic. Oh, you've changed your life.
I know, man. I need to get out more.
You don't have those great friends that you can call up
no,
and say,
not
what?
Right now. Not right
You're
now.
You're kidding.
No, I don't. I don't. I have been a hermit the last 2 years. I need to get out.
You don't have a childhood friend that you grew up with?
No, I don't, because I moved around a lot when I was young, and so I didn't make those type of bonds. And then I did when I was in the military, but I still have one friend. He moved from the East Coast to here in Chicago, but he got married, had some kids, and we don't talk much anymore, so I got to get out there and make some dang friends.
I want to find you some friends, Vic.
As you get older, it's hard to...
I think you don't need as many when you get older. What do you think, Pete?
I think you do.
I don't know.
Yes, you do need friends, man.
Maybe but there's one or two, three tops.
Ben Rector has a song. It's called You Can't Make Old Friends. That's why, you know, you grow up with these people that you can trust and you can go back to and say, hey, I need to have a heart-to-heart. You know, wow, I feel bad for you. I can be your guy.
No, don't feel bad. I'm happy. It's one of those things I'm focusing on. I do need, because that's important. You're right. It is important to have some friendships
outside of
your relationship.
Were you in a military family?
Sort of. Not really. My dad did serve, but he was in the airline, so we did move around a lot.
Okay. Maybe it becomes a trust thing because you knew you were going to move and you didn't really trust people, so you didn't let them in.
Well, and it's even simpler than that. I think that's probably true, but it's even simpler than that. You know, you make a friendship, you build a friendship for a couple of years, and then you're moved.
Right.
So what are you going to do? It just comes with the territory of moving around. Yeah, I'm almost like a military brat. That's what they call them, but because I did move around every 5 years tops.
I think there's an app to make friends.
No.
I'm just throwing
really?
It out there. Yeah, there is.
Do Facebook friends count? Instagram friends?
No.
No.
They don't?
They're important. They're important because you can learn a lot from them and things, but I don't think that's
I love when you see people that you haven't seen for a while and they say, hey, we're Facebook friends. I'm like, what? Oh, okay. That's great. I can only do so much on social media. That's the thing. Only so much. Vic, I'm your guy if you need somebody to call. you need to make a serious decision.
What's your number? Maybe we'll wait till off the air.
It's 312. Yeah. Pete McMurray in the Allstate Skyline Studios. Quick break. And we have Nick coming up next at 720. WGN. All right, that does it for us. Nick is up next. We'll be back tomorrow night after the Sox game. So we go on around 10:30 or so.
Yep.
Is that right? So I can go out tomorrow night and show up about 10?
Great.
Hop on the air? You don't care. You just don't care. You don't even like me when I text Vince and you throughout the day. It's like, I got another text message from Pete. This guy is so needy. He really is. You guys have a great night. We'll see you tomorrow.